The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. The silly season always used to be the time when politics stopped. But in August 2015, there's politics aplenty. The only question is whether it's politics of a wildly silly stripe. To the horror of Tony Blair and the Labour establishment, Jeremy Corbyn has shot out of backbench obscurity to become the shock favourite for party leader. The ballot papers are being sent out tomorrow, but if you believe the pollsters, it's a one-horse race. Joining me in the pod to discuss Labour's flash of summer lightning are Owen Jones, Anne Perkins, and by the wonder of Skype, John Harris. Warm welcome to you all. But before we bring in our resident Guardian experts, let's do a quick sanity check on whether the political world is, yet again, getting ahead of itself. Labour MPs, hardened lobby hacks, and even Corbyn himself have all been stunned by the couple of YouGov polls that have shown the bearded leftist from Islington North on track to take command of his party, possibly with an outright majority on the first round. But I asked Mike Smithson of politicalbetting.com, a pundit who puts his money where his mouth is, should we trust polling surveys like this at all so soon after they got the general election wrong?
Well, it is very difficult to base anything on polls at the moment, and pollsters have got a lot of work to do to restore confidence. This will be the first election that will be tested against real results. But looking at it and looking at the sheer scale of Corbyn's lead in the two published YouGov polls that have been, it is hard to see anything other than a Corbyn victory.
Just the sheer scale?
The sheer scale of it. Okay, at the general election, we saw the pollsters generally had the gap at about 1% between Labour and the Tories, and in fact, it finished up at 6%. That's one thing. But when you're talking about Corbyn on 53% and 32% ahead of Andy Burnham, whatever it is, that is just massive. I can't see how that can be turned around. It might be narrower, it might be tighter, it might be that Corbyn doesn't top the 50% mark, and then second preferences will come into play from the lower placed candidates, and I think that possibly would, if it got to that stage, I think that would help Cooper rather than Burnham on the first recount. And it might be then that Cooper found herself in second place, but again, that's pure speculation. We don't know, and I think we've just got to assume that a lead of this magnitude is going to lead to a Corbyn victory.
And if we just try and pick into why that might be, we know that the Labour has, since the last time this was done in 2010 when Ed Miliband was picked, has reformed the way it picked its leader. Can you just talk us through what the change was and whether you see that as affecting the result this time?
Yes, I mean, it used to be that there was an electoral college which was divided into thirds. So MPs represented a third of that. So-called affiliated organisations, mostly the trade unions, represented a third, and the ordinary party members represented a third. Now that's been changed completely. Labour MPs don't have their supercharged third of the overall electoral college. They're just voting like ordinary members. Trade unionists have had to specifically register with the party in order to get on the ballot. And of course, we've got this weird £3 sign up, so anybody can sign up.
And then within that, all votes are equal. And do you think that is affecting what's going on?
I think it probably is, yes. I think that it means that members are more empowered. It certainly means that the trade unionists who vote have much more say than perhaps they did 5 years ago. And remember, 5 years ago, it was the trade unionists who put Ed Miliband over the line rather than David Miliband.
Presumably, though, it also makes this electorate harder to sample.
Yeah, absolutely. It is fiendishly difficult. And I've YouGov is very good at this, but they can have got it wrong. And in fact, I think Peter Kellner has expressed the concerns about how you actually go about this. Basically, YouGov's got a polling panel of about 500,000 people, and it will have asked over the years, are you a member of parties? And presumably it's got a list of people on its panel who are Labour Party members. It will, I guess, as well have asked at some stage whether people are trade union affiliates and trade union members. And it will have asked as well in recent times, are people, have they signed up to the £3 scheme? And those people then will have been part chosen for the sample on which the latest polling is based.
And finally, as a betting man, we should just ask you, is it possible, as Corbyn himself, of course, is maintaining that he could be at the helm of a Labour Party that could then go on and carry the country?
I would never say no. And indeed, it would be interesting to see how the Tories react. And it might be that the hubris from the Tories, that might well change perceptions. I don't know. I mean, I certainly wouldn't be betting on anything other than a Conservative victory in 2020, based on what we know at the moment.
Mike Smithson there, suggesting that even if the runes are hard to read this time, we do indeed have to take extremely seriously the possibility that Jeremy Corbyn could now be the next leader of the Labour Party. And if you'd made this up a couple of months ago, no one would have believed it. No one in the Westminster bubble, at any rate.
But like these things, you know, once it's happened, you think, crikey, why didn't we see that coming? I mean, in a way, you kind of think, well, it's kind of completely obvious. If you open up the Labour electorate to ordinary people who think things are going badly wrong at Westminster, you're likely to get a complete outsider as candidate. But somehow we weren't looking that way when the choice came. We weren't looking that way when we argued that we thought Jeremy Corbyn should be lent some support so that he got enough sponsors to be on the ballot paper. And now look what's happened.
John, do you agree with that? I mean, you spend your time reporting politics from anywhere but Westminster. Does that mean you saw it coming a bit more?
No, I wouldn't say I saw it coming. I don't think anyone would, least of all Jeremy Corbyn himself, necessarily. I mean, the yardstick by which one compared his chances early on was probably what happened to Diane Abbott in 2010, which was that, broadly speaking, it was a good thing that he was there to widen the debate and so on. But the idea that he would be the front runner, let alone by this margin, I don't think anyone saw coming. I spoke to someone the other day who told me they'd got odds at Betfair initially of about 900-1. So when I sensed it starting to change was before that YouGov poll was released. Was on, I went to the Tolpuddle Festival, which happens every year, is organised by trade unions in the southwest. It's sort of a left-wing Glastonbury. And there were times there must have been 3,000 or 4,000 people there where you couldn't see anyone who didn't have a JC sticker on. And I thought at that point, ooh, something's happening here.
Owen, you, I think, have helped Corbyn launch his youth campaign. What sort of reaction are you seeing at his meetings and so on?
Well, it's difficult, really, to kind of sum it up adequately because, you know, they say politics is showbiz for ugly people, but in a way, Jeremy Corbyn has become something of a political rock star. It's incredible in 2015 to see people queuing around the blocks to see a politician speak. He went to Llandudno the other day. A 1 in 40 of the town's population came to listen to him speak. And I have to say, I'll let you in on a little secret. When he got on the ballot paper, I felt slight trepidation because I feared that he could end up a poll last, that would be seen as a rout for the left of the party. For me, a good result would have been he coming third and perhaps Liz Kendall in fourth place. What I think has happened is, A, the heirs to New Labour no longer have any vision, coherent vision, no coherent set of policies, and a huge vacuum has been left. And B, if we look at the rise of everything from the SNP to UKIP to across Europe, the rise of populist right and populist left movements, in a way we were overdue for something like this. It's just expressed itself within the Labour Party, but that's our political tradition of a progressive movement in England and Wales. So in a sense, if it was going to happen, it was going to be like this.
So we all kind of now know we should have seen this coming, even though, like Owen happily confesses, none of us did. I mean, the question, of course, is whether this obviously reflects a kind of feeling of anguish in the Labour Party and the broader Labour family and the left family against what happened with the result. But the question, Anne,
that Blair and others are putting is whether that means that that Labour part of the electorate is in danger of becoming further and further away from Middle Britain that swung the election for the Tories just a few months ago.
You know, certainly John Cruddas has done some very interesting polling which suggests that that's exactly what's happening. And I think it just presents a kind of a huge and anguishing problem, because nobody wants to kind of rain on this kind of sort of fantastic parade of energy and idealism and aspiration in a kind of big political sense, or the desire to get politically engaged. But you kind of always have that nagging feeling in the back of your head. You know, how are you going to actually kind of turn this into a set of election winning policies that will appeal to what is increasingly a socially conservative electorate with an increasingly individualistic and not collective approach to politics and the kind of politics, the kind of political leadership they want to see?
John, we can see all the problems, but I suppose on the other side, you'd have to say that if Labour was set about to pick, say, Liz Kendall, or, you know, someone who was following the 1997 playbook much more closely, that would bring quite serious problems of its own, wouldn't it?
I think that's the nature of this contest, really, and probably one of the reasons that Jeremy Corbyn is doing as well as he is that it's not as if either of the other three candidates look destined to romp home in 2020. The Labour Party's problems transcend questions of policy, and as and when or if Jeremy Corbyn takes over, they'll hit him as hard as they hit any of the other candidates. They're to do with structural decline, they're to do with the fact that the Labour Party is invisible in large swathes of the country, they're to do with the decline of the trade union movement, they're to do really with an existential question, which is, if you're a workers' party that was founded in the industrial age, what do you do in the post-industrial age? So this is huge stuff, and I think the Corbyn insurgency, so to speak, is probably the first time that we've had a sense of how grave the crisis is.
Owen, there's a saying in finance, which is that when people say different this time, that's time to worry. It means that there's a bubble on the way. And people who remember the early 80s feel very strongly that something similar is happening here this time. Is there any reason why we should believe it's different this time compared to the early 80s?
I think politics is far more complicated, partly for the reasons John explains. We've had a huge shift in the structure of the economy and the workforce. Yes, we no longer have an industrial workforce with communities organised around their workplaces, mines and steelworks. These days, you know, people work more likely in supermarkets and call centres and offices, and you don't have communities around there. So work life and life full stop is far more transient and atomised and fragmented. And any new left movement has to take that into account. But, you know, you look at how febrile politics is. I mean, take Scotland. The Scottish National Party had, what, 6 or 7 seats in 2010, and they shot up to 56 5 years later, and that was the heartland of the Labour Party, Scottish Labourism, has all but imploded there. You've obviously seen the rise of UKIP, 4 million votes. You've seen the rise of the Greens. I think politics is certainly more fragmented and becoming far more complicated, and it's not going to go back to a two-party system anytime soon. But I think what I guess for me has to happen is, can you build a left which is genuinely on the left, if you like, but which can unite middle-income and low-income Britons? That's the majority of society. That can mobilise people who don't vote, who voted for UKIP in Scotland, obviously, who voted for the SNP, who can particularly get young people who, I mean, Labour got their second best result amongst 18 to 24-year-olds since 1974 at this election. The problem is less than half actually obviously came out to vote. And I suppose what I think is interesting about this is the narrative we've had is democracy is in decline, membership of political parties is in terminal decline, voter turnout is in decline. Scotland shows that's not the case, and you've seen this huge politicisation take place. Could the same thing now be happening in England and Wales, where you've seen a dramatic surge in party membership and party affiliation to the Labour Party? If Jeremy Corbyn wins, could the number of people joining increase yet further? And could you genuinely have a huge movement that can actually go out into communities and politicise people? I don't know the answer to that, but I look at Scotland and I would suggest that is now one of the most politicised nations probably in the Western world. And perhaps the same thing in a different way could happen in England and Wales.
My concern with Corbyn as the figurehead for a sort of a burgeoning movement is that his politics seems so old-fashioned. I don't think his politics, personally, and a lot of the people around him's politics go with the grain of where we are. Up to the advent of Corbyn mania, whenever I chaired or spoke at meetings post-election about the sense of crisis around British politics, the first questions that were asked were always about electoral reform, you know, and the fact we've got a government elected on 24% of the support of 24% of the electorate. Jeremy Corbyn doesn't talk about that. He doesn't talk about working with other parties. He doesn't really talk about recognising that the British state needs a drastic overhaul. There's none of that with him at all. It seems to me to be in danger of being a very old-fashioned left politics, which is about grabbing the same old levers as ever and pulling them in a more left-wing way. So it's exciting when it's insurgent, but when the time comes to actually say meaningful things that go with the grain of where we are, I think it'll be found wanting. That's not to say that Andy Burnham or Yvette Cooper or Liz Kendall wouldn't have been found wanting, but I think that's a big issue.
I think you're right, but nobody ever won an election by advocating electoral reform, did they? And I think, you know, I think it's a bit harsh to criticise them for not looking at the kind of granularity of how you get to where you want to be, when you've really got to be in the business of selling an idea to start with. But although I agree with Owen that it's kind of astonishing, really gobsmacking, the number of people who've signed up in the last month or so, that include my own daughters, I must say. So it's certainly not all people signing up through trade unions, and it's not all, you know, it's a lot of people who just think...
Even the children of Guardian colonists are signing up.
Even the children of Guardian writers are signing up. No, but more is the point. You know, they've not, you know, especially one of them, has never been kind of particularly engaged. And of course, one of the points about this thing is you're offering people the chance to make one of the big decisions, viz. To choose a leader. So you're kind of holding out the cherry for as a kind of award for joining up, which is a kind of big thing to do. But even so, it's a huge number of people, but it's still not much more than 1% of the electorate, is it? I mean, you've still got a huge way to go to convert that energy into anything that, as John says, you know, really reflects the big problems that the left is facing.
I'm not sure you'll do it on the back of advocating renationalising things, reopening coal mines and having a Ministry of Labour. I mean, that's three of the things he's talked about lately.
Well, just on what Anne says, I mean, obviously it's only 1% of the electorate, but let's bear in mind, this has happened in about 8 weeks. I do not think party membership in Britain of any party has increased at this rate ever. And who knows in that case what's going to happen in 3 months' time. Perhaps this is the peak, and if he becomes leader, nothing more will happen. But I'd be sceptical about that. I mean, in terms of being forward-looking, that is the challenge of the left often, because the left for a long time has been on the defensive, has been on retreat, and has resorted basically to sloganising. Stop the cuts, stop privatisation, stop the world, I want to get off. But I actually think the only reason Jeremy's done so well is his opponents have absolutely no clear vision of anything whatsoever. New Labour had investment in public services. The heirs to New Labour have renounced that. They had LGBT rights. Well, the Tories have accepted that. They had devolution. Everybody accepts that, of course, now. The minimum wage and so on. They have no distinct, clear message whatsoever. And actually, Jeremy Corbyn is talking about things like how you modernise the economy, the infrastructure of this country, a public investment bank to promote, for example, the high-skilled jobs, the renewable energy jobs of the future, so we don't go back to the old industries, which are just obviously never going to come back. And I have to say, if he was so backward-looking, why is it the most enthusiastic supporters of his are people often who are young? I mean, according to the YouGov poll, he's got across-the-generation support. Working-class supporters of Labour apparently are more likely to support him than middle-class supporters. But the most enthusiastic are young people because they feel robbed of a future. Their ambitions devoured by the housing crisis, a lack of secure, skilled jobs, saddled with debt for aspiring to university. I think he's speaking to those people, and that's partly why he's doing well. But look, I'm not saying he won't face formidable, incredible, overwhelming odds stacked against him if he wins, and it will be a terrifying time in lots of ways for those who currently feel that hope. And the question is, how do you build a counterweight to that? And that is still unanswered.
Isn't there another question though, Owen? I mean, like Anne, I've got anecdotal experience. I went to the wedding the other day and met four people all at one table, all signing up one way or another to vote for Jeremy Corbyn. And so there were people who liked their politics but hadn't liked New Labour. There's a big chunk of people out there. But there's still a lot more people in places like Nantwich that decided decided the last general election who aren't very interested in politics and Nantwich and don't much like their aren't interested in political vision, and what their votes are driven by is much more fear, and in the case of the last election, driven by a fear that Labour couldn't be trusted with the money. And the cephalogy does suggest that you need to win those people back, particularly from the Tories. and if Labour's to get a shot of governing again. And I'm wondering, do you really think there could be people out there who voted Tory in May but might consider voting Labour if Jeremy Corbyn was in charge?
Well, I think what happened with the election, let's not forget, was the double whammy of Scotland, i.e. you lose 40 seats to the Scottish National Party, but then that has a huge impact in England and Wales because people didn't, well, the idea, which was whipped up, of a party committed to the breakup of the United Kingdom having a veto effectively over a Labour government. And, you know, that hit home to me when I spoke to a senior Unite person, and he spoke about his trade union branch, lifelong activists, Labour supporters, saying we don't want the Scots running the country. So that obviously had a big impact. The other was the fact that Labour capitulated, and this is where I agree with Alistair Campbell, for heaven's sake, which is that the myth that the reason we're in this mess is because Labour spent too much money, even though the Tories backed their spending pound for pound. And therefore, the whole narrative of why hand the keys back to the driver who crashed the car was extremely salient. I think that has to be challenged. The other was they had no coherent alternative. They tried to win by being the political wing of Witch magazine. But I actually think people, and I say this a huge amount, it's not about, for me, most people, you don't knock on a door, go into a pub and people are talking about left wing or right wing. They're thinking about policies which are coherent, which answer their everyday problems and concerns about the future of their children, about their, you know, housing, their jobs. And I think if he can inspire people who didn't vote, people who voted for the SNP, people who voted for UKIP, and there was a poll of UKIP voters, still an early poll, but saying the preferred leader for them to make them come back to Labour was actually Jeremy Corbyn. So things can be surprising.
Can I just ask Owen just one very quick question? I just wonder why, if you belong to the SNP, you'd want to vote for Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, the reason so many...
I mean, not because they're Scottish Nationalists, but I'm just wondering what... You know, I think it's a really important question whether Jeremy Corbyn can offer something different from what the SNP is offering, apart from support for the union.
Oh, well, I think they could offer. He could offer a far more progressive platform than what the SNP is offering. And often, actually, it's the positioning of the SNP rather than what they do in practice, which I think resonates with people. But in Scotland, it's incredible. And, people who've defected from Labour to the SNP have often the bitterness of ex-lovers and the passion of the convert. They regard the old party as the red Tories who lined up in a campaign of fear against them. No, I can't see the other three candidates having a hope in hell, I'm afraid, of winning back those supporters. Could Jeremy? I don't know, but I think he probably has a far better chance.
John, let's just talk about him for a minute as a as a potential figurehead and how he measures up against the other candidates. It's remarkable we're hardly mentioning Yvette Cooper or Andy Burnham or Liz Kendall. How do you think they just play with people who are kind of half watching the telly?
Well, I think what the Corbyn surge highlights really is something both within that sort of 400,000-600,000 electorate, it's quite a sizable body of people, but I think it's something true of the electorate as a whole, which is that sort of robotic spadocracy, hard-working families talking riddles model of politics doesn't work on the left or the centre left at all. I mean, I thought Yvette Cooper was all over when my mum, who's a member of the Labour Party, came to visit me, and she gave me this Yvette Cooper card on it. Please share your views on these policies. And you have to tick box one is strongly disagree and box five is strongly agree. And it says end child poverty in a generation. Like, you're meant to sit there and go, well, I agree with that, not strongly agree. It says 300,000 homes a year must be built. Agree, strongly agree, disagree. I just thought these people have lost, if they ever had it, they've lost the ability to even talk to their own people, right? I think that's true of her. I think it's true of Andy Burnham to some extent, despite his protestations to the contrary. I think Liz Kendall has one asset, which is that she affects to look sort of fearlessly into the future and talk to the Labour Party about the grave crisis it faces. But I think a lot of her conclusions are all wrong. And similarly, she has this very sort of aloof, distant, slightly weird style of presentation. So I think that type of Labour politics, I don't see whatever happens to Jeremy Corbyn,
don't you
how
think
it can return, really, because it's been found out.
It's that kind of politics full stop, because I think the Tories are just as guilty of talking in
No, I actually think Cameron and Osborne are more effective communicators than either of the three other candidates. I really do.
Definitely, I agree with that.
I think they're more effective, but I still think they've got a problem with people not feeling they don't engage with them.
Yeah, but they have a story, which is that we're going to tarmac Britain in our hard hats and anyone on benefits can get stuffed.
But hold on.
And that's very incisive. Compared to that, I don't know what Yvette Cooper or Andy Burnham's message is.
But does Jeremy Corbyn really bring back things to, you know, what this means for your mortgage or for how much it costs you to buy your shopping or whether you're likely to be able to get a better job? Doesn't he too have a danger of talking a bit in abstractions, if not in clichés of hardworking families? He talks that rather level of lofty principle, don't you think?
Yeah, well, I think that's what I was alluding to before. You know, I'm not sure standing there talking about renationalising things is the key to, if you can at all, re-establish Labour as a political force.
But that point I made was about it's the professionalisation of politics, where instead of a movement, if you like, the Labour Party being a movement rooted in people's communities, instead it's become, you know, you go to a think tank or become a special advisor and then you parachute into a constituency you've never heard of. And when Ed Miliband was called wonky and geeky, well, he was just symptomatic of a broader problem of the political elite, which is it's become so professionalised now they sound like a bunch of management consultants with very technocratic messages which can't translate to people who are sitting in a pub trying to work out what politicians actually think about anything anymore.
And given that you've been... Well, we've all admitted to being taken somewhat surprised by what's happened. But given what Owen's talked about, you know, the disgust at the narrow Westminster class, the kind of broader kickback against conventional politics, whether it's, you know, from Marine Le Pen to Gerry Adams all across Europe with the austerity and everything, do you think that Jeremy Corbyn could surprise us again and do much better, not just in this election, but in the election that matters in a few years' time, than people are giving him any credit for?
No, I don't. I don't think that he's got... I think it might be, you know, an even more disastrous kind of turnout and engagement than the last time, but I really, really don't think that Corbyn can do it. I really, really do think that, you know, the next Labour government is a long way off at the moment.
And John, do you agree with that, or are you more optimistic?
No, I think I probably do agree with it. But I as I said earlier, I don't think Yvette Cooper or Andy Burnham or Liz Kendall have any signs of romping home in 2020. Prior to the Corbyn insurgency, and I've said this in my writing and the films that we make and so on, I think that the revival or reinvention of the left or centre left in England and Wales is probably going to take 10, 15, 20 years. You know, we might be in 1900 or 1910 compared to the arrival of 1945, finally. It's going to be a long haul. And what's happening here indicates the gravity of the crisis and the fact that people require something better. We'll have to see where we are in 2017 or 2018, you know. There's no easy answers to any of this. It's complicated.
Now, Owen, I'm not going to ask you the same question about whether you're more optimistic, because you've already said that you are. But
well,
I just...
caveats. No, that's important that I caveat that. As I've said, any Labour leader faces formidable challenges and obstacles. Jeremy Corbyn-led Labour will face the biggest onslaught of any Labour leader by the establishment and including people within his own party. It will be very messy, and that's why you need a big movement that can inspire people.
But that brings us on to what I was going to say, is just how would you see it working in terms of not just, you know, an establishment, a right-wing press and all those things, but in terms of a parliamentary opposition when so many of the MPs would be against him? Do you think they'd fall into line, or do you think we'd be looking at a kind of split situation?
Well, I think the way to do it is, firstly, if he does win, he has won the biggest against the odds victory in the history, not just of, I mean, what, of any major party? I mean, he's just gone from, John would say you could get, what, 900 to 1 odds. So given he was an unknown backbencher against people, Andy Burnham's almost a household name.
Oh, give over, come on. Which household are you talking about?
Well, fair point.
His own.
He's a legend in his own lunchtime. Look, he's been around for many, many years. Fair enough, that's a very good point. But nonetheless, it is a formidable victory if he pulls it off, and it will have the biggest mandate of any Labour leader in the history of the Labour Party. But what he'd have to do, I think, is get together a big, the most democratic, broad-based conference ever to debate policies and lock in the parliamentary Labour Party to that on the basis of, look, we've got the biggest party we've got now for generations. We're going to democratically decide these policies. If you're not going to accept those policies, you're not defying me. You're defying a huge number of people who've been politicised in the most democratic, broad-based party we have ever had in the history of this party. If people don't fit in with that, it will be difficult. And bear in mind, obviously, they're going to redraw the parliamentary boundaries, so there will be lots of MPs up for re-selection. And the CLPs who will be re-selecting them, as we've now discovered, look a lot different from the constituency Labour parties that selected them in the first place.
I think that's a really, really ominous thing to say, Owen.
It's not a threat. I'm just saying, I mean, it's not me threatening the MPs.
Oh, I'm too old to read it any other way.
I'm saying that if you have a party which has changed in this way, I think lots of Labour MPs will be looking to their constituency Labour parties and thinking that obviously they have to listen to their activists, and their activists have changed. I don't think that the one thing that is important, and just to follow on from that, to make sure it doesn't sound ominous, the key thing Jeremy Corbyn has to do is emphasise the broadest possible church, the most inclusive approach, where all wings of the party feel at home. My only point was, if MPs en masse start going on strike and refusing to even cooperate with the party leadership, then obviously I think they'd end up in a bit of a mess.
Okay, one last word to John Harris, and then we're going to wrap up.
I don't want to end this on a necessarily pessimistic note, but the only other thing I think we have to beware of is what I call Dianaism, right? Which is that because the news agenda moves so quickly, these things happen, and they're often very, very spectacular, right? The Green Surge, the rise of UKIP, the SNP, that even going back to 2003, before social media, a million people on the street to oppose the Iraq war and so on. But that doesn't mean clearly that they endure, and it doesn't mean that they're that deep-seated. So you have to be careful here, that's all. Because if I was Jeremy Corbyn, what I would fear is that a lot of this would fritter away, and by 2017, 2018, he might be quite a lonely figure. I think that's the biggest challenge he faces if he wins, and it's by no means certain which way that'll go.
Well, the immediate question is whether or not it fritters away by September the 12th, which is when we get the results. There's going to be an awful lot to speculate on, chew over, and debate between now and then, which I'm sure we'll be doing. My thanks to our guests, Owen Jones, Anne Perkins and John Harris. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When it's time to create a website for whatever's newsworthy in your life, whether that's a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or just a blog, go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.